From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made just about an hour ago when the Henrietta Board of Ethics decided that it will not take any action against town supervisor Jack Moore. The board met this morning to consider the recent controversy involving the supervisor who was caught on tape making racially charged remarks about African Americans. That tape first broadcast by 13 Wham News, and 13 Wham News reporting today again that the Board of Ethics announced it does not have legal standing to come forward with any action against the supervisor. Now, Supervisor Moore in that tape referred to African Americans as, quote, city cousins, and belittled African Americans in conversation with town employees. The supervisor has apologized and says he has taken sensitivity training. But what does sensitivity training mean anyway? How does it work? How long does it take? Who runs the training? How do we know if the person undergoing the training, such as Henrietta Supervisor Jack Moore, actually gets anything out of it? And how is it different compared to anti-racism training? My guest for the hour is someone who conducts anti-racism training. Reverend Myra Brown is a parish minister at Spiritus Christi Church. She's the founder and organizer of SPARC, the Spiritus Christi Anti-Racism Coalition, and her work in anti-racism training has taken her across the country. But she's with us for the hour here in studio on Connections. Reverend Brown, great to have you.
It's good to be here.
Let me start here. Jack Moore says he took sensitivity training, not the same thing as anti-racism training. Is that right?
No, they're very different.
How is that?
Well, sensitivity training is a training that's generally done in small groups and with people to help them learn how to be more sensitive to each other in a workplace, kind of understanding themselves. They may look at some personal prejudice, but they really just kind of scrape the surface. What it doesn't consider, and it sort of reduces, right, prejudice to just being insensitive. So for one, what Jack Moore did was not just insensitive. It was racist, which requires, I think, anti-racism training, not sensitivity training. Just being aware of your statements and how to interact with people in the workplace will not bring that deep transformation so that actually he's able to, or anybody who would find themselves in his position would be able to actually create an organizational culture, right, where there is full equity for people, not only in thinking, but in policy and procedure and all those things. So sensitivity training really is just kind of, let's be aware of what you can and cannot say. I attended sensitivity training once, actually maybe twice, but I remember once, this one particular time that I attended it. It was because a white employee said, I was having a conversation with a black employee who was telling me about a park in Chilai, Black Creek Park. And a white employee walked up to me and said, "Shh, we don't want people in the city knowing about our park." Right. And it was really kind of a series of racialized things that had happened on this particular unit at this particular facility that I'd worked with. And so I went to the supervisor and said, you know what, we've had a number of things. You know, we've had issues around whether we have a black angel on a tree or a white angel for Christmas. We've had employees coming up, this employee coming up to interrupt me around these things. We've had patients who would say the most racist things to black employees. And none of those things got addressed. Everything just sort of got pushed away or diminished. And so we finally, the organization said, we're going to have sensitivity training. And pretty much what it was they hired somebody who came in and the person simply told the white people that they couldn't say those kinds of things. That if they wanted to say it at home or on their own time, they could do those things. But in the workplace, it was not going to be tolerated. The end result was, as people left that training, I noticed that the white people were kind of converging with each other. And they were saying things like, well, I guess we have to watch what we say around here. So they left that training not with any deep awareness of, I need to really do some deep change. It was, I need to be more careful that I don't get caught doing this anymore in the workplace.
And it wasn't about looking at the root causes or what racism truly is or means, right?
That's right.
That's what you're saying?
It doesn't touch what racism truly is and what it means and its full impact, whether it's intentional or unintentional.
I don't know who conducted Jack Moore's sensitivity training. Do you offhand, Myra? I don't know.
I have no idea who conducted that.
And so, again, I assume every training is somewhat different and people's qualifications are different. So I don't want to comment directly on whatever sensitivity training Jack Moore has undergone. All the reports I've heard were that it was two sessions, 2 hours each. Is that enough time to really dig into that? If you're going to be serious about trying to understand, well, I guess, like you say, the question is, are you trying to understand racism and your own biases and your own behavior, or are you not? Because 4 hours over two sessions, is that enough time to really get somewhere?
I don't think so. I think it's enough time to start something, but I don't think it's enough time to get after organizational change and really have people really make all the connections that need to be made. I know that I couldn't do anti-racism training in 4 hours for any group and really have them ready to make any kind of substantial amounts of change. People have to do at least 2 days with me to do anti-racism training, and that still is just scratching the surface. For organizations that really want to get a good foothold in creating more justice and really getting at the deep roots of racism, I would recommend that they do at least a week-long training.
Talking to Reverend Myra Brown, who's been conducting anti-racism training here and across the country since when?
Since 2005, I've been doing these trainings.
And what are the kinds of clients and people who come to you? Is it organizational? Is it individual?
Yeah. So I do it on a couple of different levels. I do it locally here for my position at the church as a parish minister. At the church, I provide anti-racism training for our members. Back in 2005, our church, and no organization is exempt, our church realized that it also had a problem with racism. My church is predominantly white. And, you know, if you are born and raised in the United States, you can't quite escape the racialized messaging that happens, you know, from the time you're a child growing up. And those things will follow you, right, if we don't take some agency to begin to do something about it. And so we had lots of stories of people of color who would come to our liturgies and not feel welcomed, comments that were made about them. We had experiences with people in the office at our parish who would kind of see my power and authority as a little bit less than the white people who I was working with, the white pastors and leaders that I was working with. And so we realized early on that we have a problem with racism here. And if we don't do something, then we're not really being true to who we say as Christians and really being true to who we say as human beings who believe in one human family. So I started doing trainings offering those for our parish. We offer those about twice a year for parishioners to really dig deep and understand the racism, to understand where it comes from, to understand the history, to be able to make those connections, and to be able to develop some action plans for their own life, personally, culturally, as well as institutionally. So I've been doing it there at the local level for our own parish. And also doing it with local organizations. So I've trained a group at the YWCA, I've trained a group at Salvation Army. We did a group for Women for Obama. I'll be doing a group for the Mennonite community coming up June 12th. So there's lots of different local groups that we've done outside of the parish as well as inside the parish. The other level that I do them is I work for a national organization based in Chicago called Call to Action, which is a national Catholic reform organization that also has recognized that racism has been part of the Catholic structure of doing business. They, as an organization, realized that they also were very homogeneous, you know, the constituency was very white. The conferences that they had every year attracted mostly white people, and they wondered, why aren't people of color coming? And there were some systemic reasons why. There were some institutional reasons why. And so they were wanting to look at their roots, the roots of the organization, and what is it that we need to do differently? And how is racism living out itself in the way that we are planning these conferences, in the ways that we're thinking about speakers, in the ways that we're thinking about what the agenda should be, in the ways in which we are either active in communities of color, in the issues that are important to them, or that we are not. And so they actually put together and put a call out for about 40 people around the country to be part of an anti-racism team. And so what I do for them is we help them organizationally look at their structures, look at their policies, their procedures, their decision-making, looking at how making sure that they are consistent with what they want to be, with what they're actually doing in the organization. And we also help them to train their regional groups. They have many regional groups around the country that are part of Call to Action that are also predominantly white. And so we go in to those groups around the country and we train them on anti-racism work. And then we invite them to get involved in their local communities and their local issues, right, and to create more justice where they are and to keep working on their own life.
We're going to talk a little bit more as we go throughout the hour about what that training entails, but I'm also curious to know if you encounter various people from organizations, no matter where they're coming from, do you find some who might come to this kind of training to quote-unquote check a box to say, okay, I did it, get off my back, I can say that I did this, can't we move on, as opposed to people who come saying, I want to understand more, and maybe I want to change. Do you see a difference in your work on this?
Yeah. In my work, generally people who choose anti-racism training want to be there.
Interesting.
Because it's frightening, really, to most white people. I mean, there are lots of people who don't choose to do this because they have preconceived ideas, right? You hear the word racism, you think, I'm not going in that room. Somebody's going to call me a racist. Somebody's going to tell me that I'm make me feel bad about myself.
Well,
I'm not going
like,
to do that.
White people seem to be obsessed with this notion of, hey, I'm not a racist. You know, we heard Jack Moore say, you know, he apologized for the remarks he made about African Americans, but he's insisting, but I know in my heart I'm not a racist. I don't know why we have this obsession with saying, do not brand me a racist. I'm not a racist. You know, as a white guy, I've got some racism in me probably from various things, and I don't think... However we define, let me ask you, how do you define what a racist is? You know, do you find this whole question kind of strange that white people are always, hey, I'm not a racist. You know, I might have been caught on tape saying that, but I'm not a racist.
Yeah, I do find it strange because I think that for me, racism, right, is race prejudice mm-hmm. plus the use of power in systems and institutions, right? And we all are participating in some system or some institution. Our families is a system. It's an institution, mm-hmm. the institution of family. So for people to think that somehow they get to escape racism is really ridiculous. If you look at the history of the United States, right, you look at the history of how we've embraced and approached difference, we've approached it in very racist ways, in very fearful ways. And white people particularly, right, have gotten caught in that. White communities have gotten caught in that. And so I think what happens is that there's such a shame about that history that one of the defense mechanisms becomes, I'm going to distance myself from that. I'm going to deny that I have anything to do with that, that there, none of that history affected me.
That never would have been me.
It's over. I would not have done that. And yet we're stuck with all the institutions. We're still living inside of institutions, right, that were built with those racist philosophies, those racist ideologies. And those notions are still alive and living and breathing in us. I mean, all you have to do is look at many of our Fortune 500 companies, and there's this transparent preference for whiteness. Like, that didn't come from anywhere, right? And so I think what I would like for white people to do, instead of being afraid and saying, don't call me a racist, take a page from the recovery community, right? Like people who are alcoholics, right? They don't say, don't call me an alcoholic. They say, I'm a recovering alcoholic. They recognize, right, that it's a problem. I think that we have to recognize, and particularly white members in our human family have to recognize that racism is a problem and that we all need to recover from this. And until we do, we're going to keep doing this kind of damage that just is irreparable. And at some point, we have to take some responsibility. Yes, they're right. You know, we weren't back there, you know, in the 1600s and the 1500s and the 1700s and 1800s. But that legacy has been delivered to us. When you are born into the world as a white person, you are born into a world of advantage for you.
Oh, yeah.
When you are born into the world as a person of color, you are born into a world that has been disadvantaged for you before you even show up, before the doctor slaps your butt and you start crying, right? That there are disadvantages waiting for you as a child of color, just as there are advantages waiting for you as a white person. And so anti-racism training helps us understand that and helps us learn how to navigate that so that we are mindful of justice. Right, that we're mindful of equality and equity with one another.
And then terminology-wise, the difference between prejudice and racism. Racism is again about power and system advantage.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And you know, before I start taking some of your phone calls, if you want to call the program as we talk about anti-racism training, what it is, maybe the difference between it and sensitivity training that we've been hearing about so much lately, especially in regards to the case of Jack Moore, Henrietta Town supervisor, you can call the program if you want to weigh in. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. My guest for the hour is Reverend Myra Brown, a parish minister at Spiritus Christi Church, the founder and organizer of SPARC, the Spiritus Christi Anti-Racism Coalition, and she's worked in anti-racism training across the country for the past decade. I don't suspect Jack Moore will be a client of yours. I don't know, and I'm sure, my guess is you'd love to sit down with him. But, you know, take us into that kind of a room where if you're sitting down with him, and he comes in and he says, Myra, first of all, you got to know, I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist, as he's been saying. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say what I say to the people who come into the room for anti-racism treatment. And sometimes we get people who come in who say, I'm not a racist, but
so
I want to do
that
something.
Too. Yeah.
I've heard that many times,
yeah.
You know, but I want to be in the room to do that. And my question is, how could you not be a racist, given what we know, given where we are, given our histories together? Giving the messages that
does that make
all
people
heard.
Defensive?
Initially, it does. It does make people defensive initially, but I think that's the beauty of having a group of people in the room, right, that look like them. And as people began to really explore that deeply, we began to look at the history of the U.S. From the vantage point of people of color. You know, what we read in our history books really is from the vantage point of the victor. Right, those who are white and had resources to write the story. It matters who gets to tell the story. But there's two sides to every story. And so we actually show them the other side that's missing. Like, how did people of color experience that history, as opposed to how it got written into our history books and the books that are on our shelves in our colleges, right? And so we talk about, like, what would that feel like if you were to trade places? Like, can you understand, like, where some of the anger comes from, some of the resistance, some of the distrust that's happening? Like, do you understand where those thoughts are kind of popping up from when you think to yourself, where did that come from, right? And being a racist is not a dirty word. It is the outproduct of living in a racist society. And so what we ask people to do is to be open enough and willing enough to acknowledge that we live in a racist society, and to also acknowledge that people created it. People created our racist society that we're living in, and that people can undo it. And that if we would just take courage, right, instead of being defensive, to say, you know what, maybe I do need to listen to the stories of people of color and how racism is impacting their lives. Maybe I can learn a little something here. And maybe we can actually partner to turn this thing around. And I think that anti-racism training believes that we can turn it around, right? If we open up our hearts and our minds enough to begin to make that walk together.
I suspect you've seen it.
I have seen some beautiful things. You know, I've seen people come in the room who are just really, really resistant. White males in particular have struggled in my trainings, and it's been beautiful to watch them by the end of that training, that switch go on. You know, and some of what I've heard is I came into this room and I, you know, I kept hearing all these people of color stories, but I have a story to tell. And so there's also a story around white male oppression that most white males don't get to tell and talk about, right? And so they hold on to that and feel like, you know, all these people of color are telling their story as if they're the only ones who have suffered some loss or suffered some hurt. We all have been hurt by oppression. And anti-racism training really creates the room for everybody to share that story and for us to find that commonality and actually be able to do the work together to undo racism.
Ooh, let me take our first phone call. Rich in Rochester has been waiting to jump in with Reverend Myra Brown. Rich, go ahead. Thanks.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Today is, I think this is a great conversation because this is something that, as a black male, I even struggle with. We all want to believe that we're not racist, or we don't have prejudicial views. But within a society, whatever the norms of that society are, those are the things that you will carry with you. And we all need to root out all of the objectivism we have when we objectify all kinds of people at every level. And I always thought it's a silly thing anyway, because the energy and the resources it takes to sustain racism at any level, sexism or whatever, it takes a lot of resources just to sustain it. And if you took those resources and you apply them in other places that are more positive, I think the country, I always say we're fighting with like 75% of our potential against the world as far as economics and all that because of these types of things. I just don't understand why people won't see this. What's this fear of seeing it? Because even like I said, even as a black male, I have to constantly challenge myself on sexism, racism, all those things.
Yeah.
If you're not willing to challenge yourself, I don't know if we ever get past this stuff.
Rich, Dan the line, because I'll weigh in and then the expert, Myra, will weigh in. But let me just say, I don't speak for all white people, but I can tell you as a white male who was born in middle-class America as a white male, and I've said it so many times, what could be easier than what I have? And so the temptation, I think, sometimes is to rebel against the idea that you had so much help. You want to feel like you worked hard and you earned it. And look, I think I do work hard, and I'm proud of the work that I do here. I'm proud of the work that I do in my community. But I have grown to see myself as a beneficiary of a system that has given me a much better chance to be successful, and successful sort of an amorphous word, but however you want to define it, I've got a much better chance just because of the lottery of birth than a lot of people. But I also know a lot of people, I know plenty of white people who are concerned that that invalidates their hard work. And I don't think it does, but I think it's more complex than that. Reverend Brown, what do you think?
I agree with you. I think that the whole idea, right, of meritocracy, right, that I earned everything that I got.
Yeah.
So why does the other guy pull up their bootstraps and earn what they have?
Right.
You can say that when the person has had their boots taken away from them, right? We often don't see whose shoulders we stand on. Like the fallacy of meritocracy is not that we don't work hard, but this notion that we kind of earn stuff on our own, it really is a fallacy. None of us really earn anything on our own. None of us are really starting from zero. If it weren't for the people who lived before us, right, who created some access, some resources, when you think about a lot of the historical government policies that advantaged white families to be able to get loans to buy their homes and then to be able to build equity and to be able to pass that on to their children, right, to pass on wealth. And on the other hand, during that same time period, there was an intentional, deliberate policy to not pass on those opportunities to families of color, so to disadvantage them. So when we talk about, you know, I work really hard and I earn this on my own, we can't really say that without looking back or looking down on whose shoulders we're standing on that have helped us along because of these social, cultural, institutional, and political policies, right, that have been in play for many, many years.
And let me also then add to that, I think there is a concern that some people have that by acknowledging the reality of what Reverend Brown is talking about, acknowledging the racist systems that have been in place now for centuries in this country, and not exactly the same now as they were before, but let's be honest, not eradicated at all. I think there is a concern that some have by saying, well, if we talk about this, then people of color will give up. That they'll say, well, boy, the deck is stacked against me. It's not worth trying. And the last thing we want to do is have someone say, I won't have a shot. And so it becomes a complex situation, which I think, Rich, is a well-intentioned sentiment that people have that says, okay, the reality is people of color have it harder, period, right off the bat. But if we acknowledge that too much, does that shut them down? Does that shut down their ambition? Do they stop striving? Do they give up? And that is something we don't want to happen. That doesn't mean you don't grapple with reality, though.
I'd like to touch on what you just said.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the person who says that. The person who says that has to realize that the person of color or the woman or whoever knows that from the start. And every day of our lives, I call it tap dancing. I say I tap dance every day of my life. And there is no this notion that people will give up. People never give up because they're constantly dealing with it. If people don't understand, you don't think about it every moment, but every moment it's there. And they don't realize that people who deal with the whatever ism it is, it never goes away. You sit it on the shelf for a minute and you keep going and you know that it's there. But me, like as within my profession, I still work. I don't work any less than I am, but I don't sit around and sit up there and just say, well, I'm angry at these white people because I could have this or that. I don't go through those machinations, but I still know it's there. Sometimes it actually works to my advantage to know it's there, that to know that I may be the only black person there, so therefore I stand out in that way on the positive side. But it's this notion that people walk around and say, well, shoot, I'm not going to do anything. For the simple reason that they're alive, they're doing something, and they're always struggling, they're always fighting. Most people, a lot of them don't have the tools to fight and go forward. Most of them may not have the understanding, but this notion that they give up, that's silly.
Reverend Brown?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Rich, because, I mean, the data, right, proves us otherwise. People of color didn't give up during slavery. Some of the worst times in history. They didn't give up during Jim Crow, right? They didn't give up during many of the eras of oppression. There's this indelible spirit to survive. I think we all have this indelible spirit to survive and keep pushing forward and moving forward. What I often hear is, if we talk about it, it's going to make it worse.
Which is a variation of what I'm saying. Exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, which... You know, talking about it doesn't make it worse. In fact, what I've experienced when I've had groups that train in anti-racism, it is when the white people and the people of color are in the room and they're able actually to talk about it, that something breaks in the atmosphere, and there becomes this incredible acknowledgement of each other's vulnerability. And people actually find a place to begin to walk together. Right, and being able to talk about it, to break it open. Stories come back to people that they had buried, you know, deep in their consciousness many, many years ago that they thought were irrelevant. People began to grieve things that that they had suppressed for many, many years. And there comes in that room a building of a kind of humanity where people are actually walking together, grieving together, figuring it out together. And once they get through that, then they can figure out together, like, how do we partner? How do we do this? You know, yeah, you know, I want what you want. You want what I want. How do we move forward to really be what we should have been, right? Which is one human family, trying to not only just survive, but making sure that we can all thrive here.
Rich, any other thoughts before I let you go?
And just one more thought, and this is almost a perverse way of looking at it. I've been doing lately, especially in the last few years of my life, looking at myself as a black person and realizing that, in a weird way, racism has to be embraced even by the black person in this sense. There's nothing, I always say there's nothing more quintessential than the African-American, quintessentially American. And we don't embrace, regardless of the trials and the tribulations and how we got here, the triumphs that we've had. I mean, you go from 100 years ago of being absolutely a non-human to, in many places, being very accomplished. Shoot, 30, 40, 50 years ago, we were still non-human in many parts of the country. And yet we have persevered. And I think from the black perspective but also from the white perspective, they have to see the greatness of that within this country. We always embrace the immigrants and what they bring here. In a weird sort of way, we have to embrace, regardless of how it happened, the power and the strength that it takes to have survived all this, and then many times strive. And how do we inculcate that in that entire that thought process to feel entitled as American, not and to embrace our Americanism, as weird as it may sound. I've been playing with that thought process but I think it's something that has to be looked at.
It's a great point. It's a great point because I think, again, I reject this notion of, well, people are racist or not. It's a sliding scale, and it's how much you grapple with your own prejudice and how you sort of acknowledge and deal with it, I think. And I will add to that, Rich. I think the people who are more overtly what we might traditionally say is racist will pick out the worst elements of culture, and there are people in all races and backgrounds who participate in crimes, and there are all kinds of complex issues here. But if you only point to the people who are involved in, pick whatever you want to say is a degradation of culture, drugs and crimes and joblessness and dropping out of school, then you can caricature an entire culture. Whereas what Rich is saying is a great point here. Let's turn that narrative on its head and celebrate the resiliency of people. Rich, I appreciate that. I think that is a great point. It's one that I haven't even fully in the broader context considered that way. And it's a great way to push back against some of the cultural, because the last time we talked about this last week about the Jack Moore comments, et cetera, was some people said, well, hey, he is pointing to a culture, though. Isn't it a culture? And Reverend Brown, when you hear it's a culture, what do you think, Reverend?
I think that that's ridiculous. It isn't a culture. I mean, I think every group has a subgroup of extremists, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's exactly what you say, to look for the extremist group and then to color the entire group.
Maybe that makes it easier to sort of justify in your own mind, even subconsciously, the notion that you have advantage. In your own mind, you think, well, we have an advantage, but come on, look at that culture.
It's a distancing mechanism.
Yeah.
It's a distancing and a deflecting mechanism to keep from actually grappling with the real issue of inequity, of racism, right, of disproportion and disparate treatment of human beings. And I think we should be at a point in 2015 where we say to ourselves, it's time to stop doing that.
We're going to get more of your phone calls in just a second. I see the phone ringing. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And go ahead, Val. You can grab that one. Poor Val, our engineer, is wearing lots of hats today as the phone rings, and we try to balance a lot here. But if you're just joining us, we're talking to Reverend Myra Brown from Spiritus Christi Church. She is the founder and organizer of SPARC, the Spiritus Christi Anti-Racism Coalition, and she conducts anti-racism training across the country. As we've learned this hour, it is not the same as sensitivity training, which is what Henrietta Supervisor Jack Moore describes that he decided to undergo and went to a couple of sessions of sensitivity training. And now, apparently, the supervisor of Henrietta is asking all town employees of Henrietta to go through what he calls sensitivity training. So we're talking about what anti-racism training is, how it differs with sensitivity training, how it works, and what it asks of us with someone who conducts this kind of training across the country. Short break and more of your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, farmers market season is just about upon us, and there is a new collaboration among some of the markets in our area. They're aiming to make sure the markets are accessible for everyone, serving the communities right where the markets are located. Join the conversation and find out about how this new collaboration will work next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Back to the phones, and this is Gary in Greece. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for having this program. I've had the opportunity to work alongside and hear her speak many times, and I'm glad you have her on. I've learned a lot from her, and I think it's important for us to understand when we talk about culture that, you know, way too often, first we see this as a zero-sum game, that it's either white culture or black culture. And I think to move forward in this country, we have to understand that we have an American culture. And then in the last 200-some years, what we have had is it's not just a European culture that dominates this country, but it's a European culture with an African mix. I mean, we see this in our food, we see it in our music, and we see it in many other things. And we really need to start communicating with each other, and I think understanding that this is an American culture, and that we have both races have gained from being mixed together in this country, and that's really the way to move forward. And I really appreciate what Myra's doing, and all her efforts in getting people to communicate and understand this. And really, what sensitivity is just understanding the other person. So again, I appreciate the work, and maybe some comments on this just being an American culture.
Gary, thank you for the phone call. Myra?
Hi, Gary. Yeah, I appreciate that too, that this is our collective experience, right? We are here together, and we are all Americans, and this is our culture, and that's why we have to take some responsibility for making sure we shape this culture the way that we want it to be. To be able to take some agency where we are, to begin to have these conversations, to encourage our family members, our friends, our coworkers I would encourage everybody to take anti-racism training, because where else do you get to pause and create a space to unpack these things, right? To unpack the history, to unpack the connections, to look at the resilience, to look at the people who came before us, who kind of modeled for us, right? How we can create what we want to see in the world, as opposed to waiting for other people to do it. Like, we are the answer that we've been waiting for, and anti-racism training is a wonderful way to call white people and people of color together and keep reminding them that we are all part of this one human family, and that we have some responsibility in that, right? That we can't just sit on the sidelines and hope that somebody else is going to do it, but that we have to kind of throw our hats in the ring and say, you know what? I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to be part of doing this, because I want to leave a better legacy for my children and my grandchildren when they come along, that they find a better world than how I found it. And I think that's the beauty of the human spirit, that we're not only capable of doing that, but we should do that.
Kat in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Kat.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Kat.
Pat, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Thanks.
Hi, Myra.
Hi, Pat.
I'm so glad you're there today, and it's a great program. I just wanted to make one comment that we have to remember that racism extends beyond just the black and white issue, that we have other people who even today suffer terribly from the results of structural and institutional racism in our Native communities, in our Asian communities, and in our Latino communities. And so often we just kind of lop them off and concentrate so much on the unique black-white situation that was so entrenched with slavery that we just forget that these others have suffered. So I just want to make that comment.
Thanks, Pat, for
that. Pat.
You're absolutely right. I mean, in the beginning of the program, when Evan and I began to talk, what I suggested is I think that every organization should take at least a week, commit to a week of anti-racism training. And if they did that, they would be able to spend time with actually all of those oppressions that you mentioned. What often happens is organizations or groups, say, yes, we want to do this, but we only want to give it 2 hours, or we only want to give it 4 hours, or we only want to give it a 6-hour day. And there's only so much that you can cover, really, in those limited times. But when organizations and individuals actually commit to the full term of anti-racism training, they can walk away with an understanding of all of those experiences of oppression and be able to realize that we have to do this work, and that it is absolutely beyond the black and white issue. There are many groups of people of color who have suffered at the hands of racism and oppression in this country, and we have to take some agency to undo that as well.
Where do you conduct the training? When you work with an organization, do you do it on their space? Do they come to you?
We do both. So we can do it at our space at Spiritus Christi Church, which is at 121 North Fitzhugh Street, or we can go out and we can do it at their space. So we did the YWCA training at the YWCA. We're doing the Mennonite training at a location that they're obtaining for us to go to. I did the training in Nebraska at the University of Nebraska. So we will go wherever people would like to gather to have this training done. So, yeah, we're very movable and mobile.
I didn't know if I wanted to go here this hour, but, you know, I think it is a logical question. And maybe it's because I've got a three-year-old who's very verbal and very social, and I look at him, and what he just wants to do is play with anyone who will play with him. That's what makes him happy at three, right?
Yeah.
You know, black, white, Latino, Asian, male, female, old, young. Well, he's prejudiced against babies because they can't walk, but, you know, because he wants to run. But I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, you know, I expect at some point, and probably soon, he will ask some kind of a question. It hasn't come up yet. And in some ways, I look forward to it. And in other ways, I think I don't know if I'm totally qualified. But I don't, you know, my wife and I have said it from the beginning. If he has legitimate questions about anything, no matter what it is, we don't dodge it. If he's asking a question, it's because he wants information. But I look at him and I'm thinking, you're entering a world where, you know, you're going to be surrounded by this in some form. And how do you raise a young boy to become a man who grows up sort of self-aware of advantage, self-aware of prejudice that may develop within you, but also free, as free as you can be of it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What do you think, Myra? Yeah.
So Jane Elliott, who's an anti-racism activist, she's a white female, has shown us, and many studies have shown us, that children get the race thing by the age of three. That's pretty young, right? Which means that they are taking in information and collecting it and drawing some kind of conclusions around race by the time they're 3 years old. So I think that what we also learned is we, as parents, you know, as information becomes available to us, right? We have learned to read to our children early, to give them content, to teach them about their colors, to have conversation with them, right? To increase their knowledge. I think that we have to not be afraid to raise these issues with our children. And I think there's lots of resources out there to be able to do it. You know, the People's Institute has lots of resources online that people can get that will help you begin to talk to children about race. Crossroads has some resources to talk to children about race. The Lutheran Church of America has some resources out there to talk to children about race. There's lots of online resources that will help us to be able to talk to children about race. But I think in some cases, it's a mistake to wait until they bring it up. I think sometimes we have to also be willing to observe what's happening in their spaces and figure out how to gently raise these questions with our children so that they are more conscious, right? That they are growing up with a sense of justice and equity around these issues, so that they have some way to be able to interpret their environment in a more just way that reflects what we want them to be thinking as parents. I remember, you know, I preach at my church, and, you know, our staff is committed to anti-racism work in the parish. We have an anti-racism mission for the parish. And I remember one Sunday I went up in the balcony to greet a couple of parishioners. And they had small children who were about the age of 3 or 4 years old. And I reached out to greet them and to hug the children. And two of the children hugged me. And the third child recoiled. And she said, "Oh," she touched my hand and she said, "She's dirty." And the mother was totally embarrassed. She just kept apologizing. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that came." Well, part of where that came from is the child didn't have any brown people in her life. And so the only notion that she had of brown skin was that there must be something wrong with this skin, because the skin of the people that were a part of her life, other than when she comes to church and sees me from the balcony, is white. And that is clean. And so anything darker than that must be dirty, right? And I felt so bad for her, because I thought all these times that, you know, that sermons have come across the pulpit about racism, those have been wonderful opportunities to have conversations with small children, you know. So what do you think? And sometimes we resist doing that because we think we're somehow going to harm them or push them somewhere that they're not ready to go. Children are brilliant. And I think we downplay their brilliance way too much. There's so much that we can both teach them, and there's a ton that we can learn from them if we start having these kinds of conversations early.
Joshua writes to the program and wants to know, in your anti-racism training, if you've ever had success with a political leader. It sounds like political leaders take these courses for cynical reasons.
Yeah, I would have to say that I don't know that any political leader has ever taken my anti-racism training. Political leaders tend to shy away from them.
They do the sensitivity training stuff, which, again, if you're just joining us, is what Jack Moore did, Henrietta Town Supervisor. Sensitivity training is not the same as anti-racism training, as we're learning. Sensitivity training tends to be shorter, maybe a couple courses like he did, I think two-hour courses. And as Myra told us, without knowing all the details of what Mr. Moore went through, it's often just a kind of advising what people shouldn't say around each other, as opposed to looking at historical reasons and roots of issues and confronting those kind of issues and considering other experiences. So yeah. So you don't have political leaders come to you for anti-racism training.
I do not. And I've talked with many political leaders over the years to invite them to undertake this kind of work. And unfortunately, very sadly, they all seem to shy away from it, you know, that the fear. And I'm not sure exactly what all the fear is, but I suspect that some of it is liability. And other times what it has been, what I've heard from some political leaders, is that my constituency is afraid. You know, they're afraid of the word racism. Can't we call it something else? And, you know, our response is, if we call it something else, then we find ourselves doing something else. But isn't it racism that we're trying to eliminate? And so if we're trying to eliminate racism, mm-hmm. we can't eliminate it without talking about it. But there's an incredible fear of just holding on to the word racism among political leaders and their constituency. And so many of them will not do it. And I think that's part of the reason that we're still wrestling with it. Because when you think of political leaders, right, the ideas of race prejudice, right, in and of itself, we all have that. We all probably have some prejudice against something that we've heard as children. But when we are able to have our systems and our institutions back up those race prejudices, then it's gone to a whole other dimension. Then we can formulate policy. Right, we can formulate practices. We can decide who will get an opportunity, who will not get an opportunity. I remember doing a training once where one of the participants, she was a white female, and she said, and it was local here in Rochester. She said, you know, one of my friends told me that she worked for an HR department here in Rochester. She said, I won't give the name because I don't have permission to give the name, but I know who they are. And she said that my friend told me that her boss in HR came to her and said, you know, we have that management position that we've put out. He said, but, you know, if we get any resumes that come in with the names Shaquita or Shaquita or any of that kind of ethnic stuff, I want you to put those resumes in this pile. Don't put them in the regular pile. And the employee said, well, why would we be doing that? He said, we're not going to hire them. Right? And so this stuff is happening, right? So somewhere inside of himself, he had some deep racialized belief and thinking about people of color that are attached to those kinds of names. And he is somewhere in Rochester using that power to impact people's lives generationally. Like, they will never be able to apply even for a managerial job that they think that they're applying for. They won't get called for an interview, right? They won't get their credentials looked at. They won't be able to set their sights on being able to, you know, make a good living, to be able to take care of send their children to school for music lessons or to a good school or to buy a house in a great neighborhood, right? And so it becomes much more than just
prejudice.
Yeah. So, and that's the danger of what Jack Moore did.
Well, and I don't mean to cut you off because we're about to run out of time here, but I'm always careful not to speak too much out of school without having, for example, a study in front of me, but I think Princeton studied this. I'll look it up. Princeton found that black people without criminal records get called back for jobs slightly less than white people with criminal records do. So we talk about banning the box, but how about just basic callbacks for jobs? Sometimes it's, what's your name? Does it sound ethnic? What's your skin color? You know, so that's why this work is so important. And Reverend Brown, I'm just so happy that you're able to take the time to come and talk to us. And let's continue the conversation on this program and elsewhere. I hope we can.
I do too.
And if our listeners want to come see you, they want to try some anti-racism training for themselves or their organizations, maybe a company, how can they contact you?
They can go to our website at www.spiritischristi.org, and they can contact me through there. They can also call the Spiritus Christi office at 325-1180, extension 117.
Reverend Myra Brown, Spiritus Christi Church, and the founder and organizer of SPARC. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Short break. Very different hour next, right here on Connections.